begin the afternoon session now. The afternoon session is on meta-analysis, and our first speaker is Tor Wager from Columbia University.
Right. Hi, everybody. I hope you ate, rested. Today's talk is on this afternoon's talk is on causal inference in meta-analysis. It's really just about meta-analysis. What I'm going to do is give you maybe I'll put this down low. Intense microphone. Is give you an overview of some different considerations in meta-analysis. Why we might want to do meta-analysis. What we can do with it, and how some of those things are done. I feel the need to first give you the why. And this is one reason. This is a graph that's taken from a recent chapter that's an overview of functional imaging that we've just recently done. And if you look at this, by publication year, the number of publications per year in PET and fMRI is increasing dramatically. I think that, yes? Oh, you know, shrink it down. Okay, and you know, I don't know about you all, but I'm having trouble reading 1,000 papers a year or something like that, and summarizing all those papers. And in fact, I even started doing meta-analysis because I found it very challenging to even read these individual papers. Like, okay, they found the singulate here, and then these people found the singulate here, and they found it over here. What do I do? You know, how do you integrate all this information? So meta-analysis is really a way of helping to integrate this vast and growing literature. That's really nice. It's all shrunken down. There's a couple of things that we can do. I've sort of categorized them into different goals. One goal is we might want to assess the consistency of activation across different laboratories and task variants. A typical meta-analysis complaint is that you're comparing apples and oranges. Certainly that's true. Every study is different in terms of its task parameters, task type, patient characteristics or population. But one of the nice things that we can do is we can say, you know, if we have something that's some knowledge that's generalizable, then we ought to be able to find those areas of the brain that are consistently activated that don't, where activity doesn't depend on the sort of minor changes in task parameters and so on. So we can assess consistency of activation. We can also compare across many types of tasks and evaluate the specificity of activated regions, particular regions, for particular psychological conditions. I think that this point is really important because meta-analysis affords a unique opportunity to compare across many different types of tasks. Emotion, memory, language, sensory motor, all kinds of different things. And how, it would be virtually impossible to perform all those different kinds of tasks within the same patient, same subjects in a particular study. And this is important because it's only by comparing across these many different types of tasks that you can say this particular activation spot or this particular pattern of activation is diagnostic or predictive of some particular psychological condition. As psychologists and neuroscientists also, this is what we really care about. We care about saying something about psychology. And to do that, you have to make comparisons, I think, across many different types of tasks, and you have to evaluate how specific patterns of brain activity are for particular task types. Also, we can use meta-analysis to identify and define the boundaries of functional regions that we can then interrogate in other ways. There are probably many goals or many things that you can accomplish. Another one is we might also be able to develop models of functional co-activation, or functional systems and pathways based on co-activation. And by co-activation, I mean if study number one activates the cingulate cortex and the frontal cortex and the cerebellum, is it also likely to activate the parietal cortex? So we can sort of start to build models of functional networks. This is just an example of this from a recent paper that's coming out by our group. And if I have time at the end, then I'll give you a little bit more detail on this. But essentially, we can measure co-activations across many regions across the brain. This is from a sample of 163 studies or 437 separate maps, statistical parametric maps. And we did several procedures that I won't describe in detail. But what you get out of it is a graph like this, where the closer the points are together on this two-dimensional graph, then the more highly co-activated they are, the more likely it is that if I activate here the IFG, I'm also going to be likely to activate the pre-SMA in the same study. So that's what these things mean. The lines show you significant connections between these different regions of the brain. And then the color codes here indicate different functional networks, essentially of regions that are distributed across space, but that tend to co-activate in different studies. So we can essentially use the meta-analysis to define the boundaries of where these regions are and how they co-activate or how these systems interact. And this can help us to make predictions and develop hypotheses about which exact areas I should care about, you know, in future studies. So this is... I'll go through each of these studies in detail, and then I won't. This is really kind of a disclaimer to say that I actually found there's, you know, I think I did a little survey of the literature, and I found something like, 40 published meta-analyses. And so I just wanted to sort of list some of those here, and you can have this as a reference and look at them later if you want some more detail. And they're grouped. I grouped them here. These are all meta-analyses of cognitive control processes. Many of them are by our meta-analysis speakers here. Emotion and motivation, a number of published meta-analyses. Disorders, particularly schizophrenia is heavily represented, depression, OCD, anxiety disorders, ADHD. Language is heavily represented, and a variety of other things, including there's the one by one of our speakers here, Angie Laird, had one of a couple papers earlier. So what else can we say from this group? I'm not going to talk about all of these different techniques. I think there's a whole variety of things. There's a whole variety of methods and conclusions that people draw from those things. So I'm really going to focus on a technique that we've been using and have developed that I'm very excited about. So I'll show you how that works. And it's called multi-level kernel density analysis. KDA. So first, why would we want to use meta-analysis to evaluate consistency? What's the big deal? Why are you even here? I suppose in this room at this moment. So this is an example from this database of emotion studies. Those are the numbers of coordinates and all that stuff. And let's say, you know, and people will ask me this. They say, okay, well, you know, we expect people to be feeling more negative emotion when we give them this aversive stimulus, and if we found activity in the amygdala or activity in the insula, that means that they must have been feeling more negative emotion. You can pick out a number of studies. Maybe I do a moral reasoning task, and I find activation in the rostral prefrontal cortex, and I say, aha, because we found this activity, that must mean that people are feeling emotional when they're doing those tasks, right? So all of these kinds of conclusions needed. Essentially an analysis of both consistency and specificity. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, you know, that I want to pick a region of interest that's an emotion region of interest. I say, I go to this particular study, one of these 164 studies, and I say, aha, here's this midbrain activation here, there's the peak activation point, and I'm going to use that as a region of interest, and then I'm going to test whether it's, you know, I use that as a marker for emotion or something. I'll just start showing you more points now, I think. This work, yeah. So these are all points from studies. We're going to see more and more. Now I'm going to show you all of the points that are all coming in from all the studies. And you can see that emotion is represented everywhere in the brain. Now the red points are from emotional experience. The yellow points are from emotion perception. But the important point here is that I could pick any region in the brain as a region of interest, and I can say very little about where emotion is in the brain. However, things are not really that bad. I'll show you whether or not that bad in a little bit. But basically, what we can do is evaluate which of those particular locations in the brain are consistently activated across studies, and there's a much more discrete and meaningful set of regions that I can then sort of conclude are involved in emotion in some way. Okay, so here's another thing. Why identify consistent areas? Well, as we all sort of really know, but we sometimes forget, making statistic maps in neuroimaging studies, which most people do, involve making many different tests, 100,000 maybe tests per brain map. Many studies use uncorrected or improperly corrected p-values. What does that mean? That means there's a lot of false positives. That in any given study, you can't pick up that study and say, well, they found activity in the cerebellum, so therefore it's really there. You don't really know until you find evidence that it's replicated again and again. How many replications does it need? That's what an analysis of consistency can tell you. This is just an example from a recent short paper. We looked at the p-value thresholds that were used this is a group of long-term memory studies. I think there are something like 170 studies. And so if you look at this, 0.001 uncorrected is the modal threshold, the most common threshold, probably because this is the default option that comes up in SPM. Another survey actually found that 80% of several hundred papers that we surveyed use SPM in their analysis. So, many studies report corrected thresholds, but if you actually look at the z-statistic values that are reported at these corrected thresholds, many of them, it's clear then from those values that they can't have been doing any meaningful correction for multiple comparisons across the brain. So how many false positives? It's very hard to obtain an accurate estimate. I'm going to spare you the details of how we got this estimate, but in this data set, we estimated 663 peaks, or 17% of reported activations, were potential false positives. Just a rough guess. We've done it in a couple different ways for different data sets. So, some number. So this is, evaluation of consistency essentially involves doing the following. This is these reported peaks from emotion studies on the medial surface. And we want to do some analysis that asks, where are the consistently activated regions where there are enough reported peaks in a given unit area in a local neighborhood to be meaningfully interpretable. And so then you see these medial prefrontal areas, limbic and brainstem areas, and other things that actually make sense in terms of what we know from animal studies. And so this is just an illustration of that on these different surfaces. So there actually are really a relatively circumscribed set of regions that we can say are consistently activated across a wide variety of emotion tasks. Of course, any particular category, subcategory within this very broad one might elicit some consistent activations in other places and so on. But I'm just illustrating here the process. Now I'll just talk. Well, I talked about this. Why we want to evaluate specificity. Just a few illustrations. So it's been claimed, for example, that the insula represents here a specific neural substrate for disgust, receiving disgust, feeling disgust in various papers. And other people, of course, have challenged that claim. And so we can use meta-analysis to potentially get an idea. This is a result from an older meta-analysis that looked specifically at the insula because of this hypothesis. And all we did here is plot the points, reported peaks, that fell within the insula from all these different categories, fear and anxiety, aggression and anger, guilt, happiness, sadness, disgust. And you can see that at least in terms of what produces functional activity in fMRI and PET studies, then there's really no specificity in any part of the insula that we can detect for disgust. So what does that mean? Sure, it might be consistently activated by disgusting stimuli or elicitations of disgust, but that doesn't imply that if I found activity in the insula, then I must be feeling disgust. Doesn't apply that kind of reverse inference. And that's what a specificity analysis can tell us in various ways. So then to extend that logic, meta-analysis can play a role in answering this question, which are, what are the neural correlates of task X, where I show you a brain map, and you get to guess what the paradigm was, what the type of task was that produced this pattern of activity. Anybody know? Guess. Somebody guess. Say something. Calculus, you're right. Because there's a frontal activity, and then there's the insula, and then there's the cingulate. No, it's pain. Thermal pain. Because I studied that a lot. Right? But you really couldn't tell. But it's also very possible that if you fed this into a machine learning algorithm along with maps from hundreds of other studies, that you could actually use this information to predict, to discriminate pain from other types of negative emotion, for example, to discriminate pain from calculus, and so on. Right? So the information could be there, but we have to do the analysis to figure out, what it is. So we might ask two questions about this. One is it reliable? If I repeated this study again and again and again, would I get the same areas, essentially? Would it be insensitive to minor variations in the task design? And then is it task specific? Is this pattern or any particular region in this map predictive of a particular psychological state? I can also extend that and ask, is it predictive of a particular psychological state, or what kind of level in the hierarchy is it predictive of? Does this map predict emotional versus cognitive processes reliably? Does it predict different types of emotion reliably, positive versus negative emotion, or within positive and negative, does it discriminate joy, contentment, and ecstasy, and sadness, disgust, and anger from one another, and so on and so on. So you can actually start to use this meta-analytic data set to establish and evaluate the level at which, the psychological level of analysis, essentially, at which there's predictive information in a brain map. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about how I like to accomplish specific kinds of these tasks. That is a very interesting start to that slide. Okay, so I'm going to describe now the basic rationale and application of this MKDA procedure, multi-level competency analysis. So it's really sort of quite a simple principle. And the idea is, I can take peak coordinate locations from a number of brain maps, and now here I see representations of peaks in a single slice from three different studies, maps from different studies. The ellipses indicate I'm going to go up to 437 of those things. Because it's very hard to count how many peaks fall exactly within one voxel, right? You think of this as a three-dimensional histogram of peaks, but it's a sparse histogram. And so in order to accumulate peaks, I can just take each of those peaks within each study and convolve it with some function. In this case, we're using a spherical kernel. And what this is then counting, this is then a map of ones and zeros, where the black areas here are one and the rest of the areas that are not shaded are zero. And then this indicates whether there is a peak close by in the local neighborhood of each of these voxels in the brain. And then what I can do is take a weighted average of those different maps, and I'll talk a little bit about the weighting a little bit later on, but I might want to weight by things like, how large was the study, how good is the study, stuff like that. And I get this weighted average, and now my next job is, of course, I have these values across the whole brain. I'd like to establish some sort of threshold and say, well, these are the areas I think are really consistent, and these are the areas that I don't have enough evidence for. And so use a Monte Carlo procedure to establish a threshold. And the idea behind the Monte Carlo procedure here, I don't think I have more details on this later. So the idea behind this Monte Carlo procedure is that we can take each of these contiguous blobby areas from within each of these studies, and we can randomize their locations over a brain, gray and white matter, essentially of a brain. And then we can recalculate under this null hypothesis that these blobs locations are essentially uniform and randomized across space. What's the probability that I'm going to get a weighted average intensity value of x? And so this distribution is a distribution of the maximum null hypothesis permuted data intensity across the whole brain. And if I threshold this distribution at the 95th percentile, for example, then I'm going to get essentially the a threshold at p is less than 0.05 in this case, correcting for search across the whole brain. So it uses a family-wise error rate correction procedure. So then what that means is the chances that I'm going to end up with an area that I'm going to call significant, but it's actually not, it's just background noise, should be should happen less than one time in 20 if I repeated the whole analysis again. So those are some details, and then you get a map of the significant regions. And this is what I was showing you before. This map, by the way, I like these things because they have a sort of interpretable metric. This weighted average map is essentially a map of the proportion of activated comparisons. So if each of these is a comparison map, you could call it a study map if you have one map per study. It's the proportion of activated comparisons from the set. So then the interpretation here is that, let's say, at least 18 studies out of 100 activated within 10 millimeters of this area. So here are some key, I suppose, points for consideration in this process. The statistic reflects the consistency across studies or across study maps. And so in this case, essentially, study a comparison map is treated as a random effect. And peaks from one particular study can't dominate the analysis by themselves, even if one particular study, let's say it's the Damasio study here, that even in this one slice, you can see there are a whole bunch of points, right? Even if Damasio just decided to report pretty much every point in the brain, you know, in the study, then that wouldn't create a significant consistent activation in the meta-analysis. Also, studies are weighted by quality. Actually, I didn't put the details in there. Oh, maybe I did. Sorry, maybe later on I'll get to that. I have some extra slides at the end, and if I actually get to them, then we can go into more details if people want to know. And also, this Monte Carlo procedure preserves the spatial covariance across those peaks. So it's less sensitive to arbitrary standards for how many peaks to report. What do I mean by that? Again, let's say there's a truly activated area in the insula of such and such a size and shape. As an investigator, and depending on how rough my statistic image is, I can choose to report, say, one peak for that whole area, or I might find one peak for that area. I might find four sub-peaks. And essentially, the methods that people use for determining how many sub-peaks there are and how many to report are fairly arbitrary. And so the nice thing about permuting the blob locations instead of just the peak locations is that I could essentially decide to report, instead of just reporting three peaks here, I could decide to report all of these peaks, and it really wouldn't change this indicator map as much, so it wouldn't really have any effect on the weighted average. Okay. Yes, this is the weighting. So in our implementation of this now, which is it's not on the web right now, but I am making it available. There's a manual. It's an 80-page manual written by Lisa Feldman Barrett in her lab. She's a collaborator of mine. That was very impressive. So this software is all implemented. The particular implementation of this weights by the square root of the sample size, because that's what the standard error is proportional to that. And also measures study quality, which you as a meta-analyst could assign based on any criteria you want. But what we have done is, you probably all know about the issue of the fixed versus random effects analysis. According to me, the fixed effects analysis is just an inappropriate method for making inferences to populations. So people hardly ever do it anymore. They usually do a random effects analysis, which means they treat subject as a random effect, make population inferences. And these studies, the z-values, or reported statistic values, tend to be much lower than in the fixed analyses. But this is also a more valid method. So we essentially have an arbitrary weighting function for this. So the ultimately, at the end of the day, I had to include a little bit of math since it's IPAM, right? this is the proportion of activating contrasts, which is... this is a contrast indicator map, so it takes a value of either 1 or 0, so it's the sum across those contrast indicator maps, weighted by this, which is the sample size for that study C or map C, divided by this normalizing constant, multiplied by a study quality weight, which we just assigned to be 0.75 for fixed effects analyses in this particular data set, and 1 for random effects analyses, so that's an example there. Okay, so you might ask, and this we keep talking about this because I have several colleagues and collaborators in statistics, and every so often we revisit this issue of, well, you know, why are you doing a Monte Carlo? Do you need to do a Monte Carlo simulation? Maybe you could derive some theoretical estimate for what this, you know, the distribution of the maximum density of these points should be using either some kind of for example, a Poisson process, or maybe a Poisson process for each study with different numbers of observation peaks for each study, and so on. And that could be, I'm really open to trying to develop something like that. But the nice thing about the simulation is that it allows, for example, a non-stationary spatial distribution of peaks under the null hypothesis. So I could have clumps of peaks, so my actual peak values don't have to be uniformly distributed across the brain under the null hypothesis. Because even in the null hypothesis, I get these wavy statistic images, and I'm going to report some clumps of peak activations, right? So this can handle that, which is very hard to do with a closed form statistical model. And this is sort of taken care of by randomizing those blob locations. Also, I get family-wise error rate control based on the distribution of maximum values across the brain, which is also difficult to handle, I think, with standard inferential statistics, with an irregular brain-shaped search volume. So it can be anything I want. I can get rid of the ventricles and not consider those, and so on. And also what it can let me do is make a cluster size inference given a primary threshold. So this is also something that we implemented. So essentially, if many of you might be familiar with cluster size inference in SPM, but the idea is one kind of threshold I can establish is I need at least a weighted average of 18 study maps out of 100 to reach statistical significance for consistent activation. Or I can say I'm going to threshold at some other lower arbitrary value, and I'm going to say that this blob in this area of the brain, in this insula or whatever, is larger than I would in extent than I would expect under the null hypothesis. And so that lets us use these alternative methods. In the Monte Carlo simulation, instead of saving in addition to saving the maximum proportion of activated comparisons across the whole brain, we're also then saving at several primary threshold choices how large the maximum cluster of contiguous regions or voxels is. Okay. So just for a comparison, I think Angie's going to talk more about this other method, the ALE, activation likelihood estimate method in particular, but just to sort of illustrate why I wanted to work on this multi-level method, I just wanted to sort of quickly compare. So I'll give a brief comparison of three different methods. There's the one I just described, this MKDA method, and there's also this ALE method, and then there's this, I'll call it kernel density analysis method. And ALE and KDA are very similar, so I'll illustrate both of those here. So in this kind of analysis, there's some publications here, I will take the peak coordinates combined across the study. So I can lump them all together into a whole set of peak coordinates. And then I'll convolve it with, if you're doing the KDA, a spherical kernel, or maybe a Gaussian kernel for the ALE. In fact, you could do this with either one, really. You're going to end up with some sort of map of either peak density within a local neighborhood or spatially weighted peak density, essentially. Peak density or ALE map, you can perform a Monte Carlo procedure, apply a significance threshold, and get significance results this way. So based on what I just told you a moment ago, the main potential issue with this is that it ignores the fact that some studies report more peaks than others, and that reporting process can be arbitrary. And in fact, in many cases, it's possible that the small studies have very rough statistic images, so they end up reporting a lot of local peaks. We actually have looked at that, did not see evidence for that in the data sets that we have, but it's certainly one factor, and it's masked by other factors. Smaller studies tend not to find things. So I don't consider, if I just consider all the points together, I'm not considering that each of those, that these peaks all came from different studies. And in fact, in this case, if I set a threshold that says I need four peaks within a local neighborhood here to reach significance and report that in the meta-analysis, then in fact Damasio alone could drive that meta-analytic result because he's reported so many peaks. So by comparison, in MKDA, the statistic reflects the consistency across studies. So it's a proportion of activated comparisons or activated study maps, and that's what I'm sort of analyzing. Instead of, so if I lump peaks together, then what I'm really analyzing is the consistency of peaks in a local area. But what I really want is how many replications across studies am I getting? That's my opinion about that. Studies are weighted by quality. That would be a nice thing. And using sort of representing the study as a level of analysis in this procedure can let me easily weight studies. Here, there can be no weighting. You can also incorporate z-score weighting, which we've tried to do, but there are several reasons why that there can be issues in that. I think I have a slide later, but I'm going to skip it in the interest of time and spare you for the moment. And here, there's this spatial covariance is preserved. So if you have some arbitrary standard for how many peaks to report, it's going to be less sensitive to that. And here, that may not be true. So differences in reporting standards, essentially the studies that decide to report more peaks for a given level of intensity of activation can tend to drive the meta-analysis. Okay, there's more stuff at the end. I think you might have access to this talk afterwards, so I have additional slides with more detail at the end, if you want it. I'm going to skip this, because Angie's here, and she's going to talk about it later. I'll skip this too. I should say that one of the considerations in all of these methods, you have to choose a local neighborhood value or a kernel value, either an ALE analysis, the full width half max of the smoothing kernel, or the radius of the spherical kernel. So you have to choose how much averaging across space you want to do. And there's no right answer for that, but we've done some tests that evaluate that. And we think that 10 to 15 millimeter radius is usually the most sensitive value. And if that is the most sensitive value, it gives you sort of an estimate of what the spatial consistency across studies is likely to be, right? So if I did study number one, I get activity at coordinates 32, 24, 32. And if I do study two again, how close to that should I really expect it to be, right? Is it plus or minus 10 to 15 millimeters once you get through all the normalization, warping, and intersubject averaging and all that kind of stuff? I think I might leave some of this for your perusal at your leisure too, if you like. But this is from a table that was in this 2007 paper that was referenced in the earlier slide. And what it does is it compares the kernel density analysis, the ALE, and then this multi-level KDA analysis on a number of different features. So you can look at the kernel, which is either spherical or Gaussian or spherical in this case. The interpretation of the statistic. And the motivation for using a spherical kernel is that you get the number of nearby peaks or the number of study maps that activate in the neighborhood. And then for ALE interpretation, we use the probability that at least one peak lies nearby or in that voxel. The null hypothesis here is that peaks are not spatially consistent. Here is that study maps are not spatially consistent. And actually, the null hypothesis for the ALE is that no peaks truly activate, but that gets a little bit. I'll leave that for later. All right. Let me see what else. I guess we'll go through this really quickly. The interpretation of a significant result. Well, for this, both of these single-level analyses, you're talking about peaks. So the interpretation, if you get a result in your meta-analysis map, is that more peaks lie near that voxel than expected by chance. The interpretation here is technically actually that one or more peaks actually lie at this voxel, although it's a little bit complicated because of the Monte Carlo procedure. It's actually testing something a little bit different. And then here, the interpretation is that a higher proportion of studies activate near this voxel than I'd expect by chance. Okay. Get that. So it talks about the multiple comparisons and weighting issues that I reviewed earlier. Okay, so now what I'd just like to do is go back to sort of an illustrative example. And this, what I'll show you are examples from several published meta-analyses that use this density analysis. And I think the results here are intended to illustrate sort of how you can then make comparisons across a number of different task domains. So these are results all mapped onto the Carrot PALS 11B atlas from studies of working memory. So it's frontal and parietal areas. Executive working memory, this is sort of a superset of those areas that show up as consistently activated. You see these areas and cerebellum and so on. Long-term memory, encoding and retrieval together, mostly driven by long-term memory retrieval. Again, even almost a superset of those areas. So we see this very sort of preserved network across these different tasks. So if you asked, is this inferior frontal junction area right here. You know, is this activity specific to more complicated, you know, memory processes, or is it also activated by sort of simple working memory maintenance? You can say, yes, it's activated across the board. What about the anterior prefrontal cortex? Well, it looks like, you know, in these maps, the anterior PFC tends to become more involved as the process gets more complex, or tends to involve manipulation of information stored in working memory. And in here, these are all mnemonic processes. You can also compare that with studies of inhibition. These are usually event-related studies that look at different kinds of response interference, more difficult or demanding response selection tasks compared to simple ones, like the Stroop task, Simon task, other kinds of interference tasks. So they're really sort of well more tightly controlled. There should be fewer processes that are involved in this comparison here. And they should be limited more to those that are involved in speeded response selection. And so in the maps here, we see that activity is limited to really a subset of these areas here. In particular, the IFJ, IFG, and task switching. You can't really see it here, but we also find activation here in both of those things. So basically, those circled areas are those that show evidence for consistent activation in each of those meta-analyses. So if you're looking for essentially candidate areas that implement very domain-general basic components of executive function, like resolving competition between competing motor responses, then these are good candidate areas. So we can start to sort of use all this information, put all these studies together, and sort of say what's consistently emerging, what's the picture. So we can map all those things onto the same brain here, and then this gives us a picture of where there are very consistent activations across these different types of studies, and then where activation is consistent specifically for the more complicated retrieval, search, manipulation tasks. And so then, if I have a study that I'm going to do on working memory, which is what we're doing now, starting a new one in my lab, I hope as we speak, then I'm going to go right to these areas. I'm going to download those maps from my website and then use them as regions of interest, and I'm going to look there first, because that gives us sort of a good consensus area to start looking at. And by the way, all those things and all the maps from all the studies that we've made are actually on my lab website, because I would like people, if they want to be able to use those, to download those and say, let's look within those consistently activated areas for activity in new studies. And actually, the reason that I started doing meta-analyses in the first place is because I was doing a Stroop-like task, and I was looking for a region of interest in the anterior cingulate, because I wanted to see whether we have anterior cingulate activity in an ROI test. And then I started looking at different papers, and I realized that I could pick anywhere in the cingulate cortex, in the medial prefrontal cortex, as a region of interest if I wanted to. I just picked a different paper. I'm like, so what's the real, which one should I pick? What's the real ROI? What's the real coordinate that I should define my sphere around? And then I started averaging the peaks together, and then it ended up being a meta-analysis. Right? So that's the idea. Okay, so now I'll talk about specificity. Specificity refers to the degree to which activity in a region or a pattern is limited to one particular type of task, psychological category. So there are a couple different ways that I'll talk briefly about. One is task-related differences in relative activation frequency across the brain. This means I'm going to compare task type A minus task type B and vice versa using this MKDA difference map procedure, and similar procedures exist for the other techniques, KDA and ALE, that I talked about before. I can also look at task-related differences in absolute activation frequency using this is probably not a great name for this, but I revised the name non-parametric chi-squared test. I'll talk about that, what that is. The point I'm going to make here is that these are both ways of comparing multiple task types and saying, where is the activation consistency different for task type A, for executive working memory than for working memory alone, for example. But they actually rely on different assumptions, and they lead to different conclusions in sort of interesting ways. I don't think there's one right or wrong method, but they're useful for different things. I'll illustrate that. We can also talk, and I'll show you just very briefly, the idea of using classifier systems to make more formal predictions from across the brain patterns, to predict task type from distributed patterns of peaks. Sam Gilbert in 2006 has one of the first, maybe the only, meta-analysis that I've seen that does this. I think that's a really great idea. So here's an example from this emotion data set. And in this case, I might be interested, you know, before I showed you maps that lump together all kinds of emotion-related tasks, you could argue that that's useful, you could argue that it's not very useful because it's too general. I'll let you decide. But one of the distinctions that we were particularly interested in is the difference between experienced emotions. Like when some of you saw this poor boy, you might have thought, well, he looks like he's in Africa, maybe his mother is dead. You know, this I start to sort of mist up. I see that. But when I see this face, it doesn't really cause in me any particular emotional experience. You might be feeling afraid. This is a standard fear face. And so activity in these, elicited by these stimuli, has sometimes been equated with fear. But it doesn't actually make you feel afraid, necessarily. Anybody feel afraid? No. Anybody laugh? Kind of funny. All right. Anyway, so we're interested in this difference. So we classified all these studies as involving experienced emotion, where people were likely to be feeling something, versus perceived emotion, or judgment of emotions in others, or stimuli. And the approach, just sort of say it, is to calculate those density maps using the Monte Carlo, the same procedures for each of two conditions separately. But in each iteration of the Monte Carlo, I might take 10,000 samples in the Monte Carlo, 10,000 randomized maps, and so on. And for every iteration in those 10,000, I'm going to calculate both of those two maps, I'm going to subtract them, I'm going to end up with a difference map. And then I can take what's the maximum difference across the brain, save that, and then, you know, save that null hypothesis distribution, develop the distribution, threshold it, and get essentially a map of where the differences between experienced and perceived emotion exceed what I'd expect by chance if they were both randomized, sort of uniform density maps. So that's the procedure. So I don't illustrate it here, I don't think, but I'll show you some results. And so these are results from a recent chapter, it's actually just out now, comparing emotional experience versus perception. And what I like about this map is that if you go back and you look at the animal literature on where you can stimulate the brain and get like really strong evoked feelings, go back to the older human brain stimulation literature where you could poke needles and they were poking needles in people's brains, stimulating them, actually eliciting reactions like rage, fear, desire to kill the experimenter, they strap them down, stuff like that. And they tend to the hot spots are in these areas like the midbrain, periaqueductal gray, around the hypothalamus and basal forebrain, the ventral insula, and believe it or not, in the deep cerebellar nuclei in there. And what this map says to me, you know, and here's the orbital frontal cortex, is that these areas that we find that are greater, more active, essentially more consistently active in experience and perception overall, map on fairly well to that sort of set of regions, to my expectations from that literature. So I'm very encouraged by that. And of course, there's also results in other areas like the dorsal medial PFC, this particular spot, that that has never been investigated in the animal studies because they don't have it. So that's also useful. This is perception greater than experience. The amygdala, for example, is actually much more reliably activated when you perceive fear in others, these expressions of fear faces, than when you're actually experiencing negative emotions yourself. This doesn't mean, of course, that amygdala means you're not feeling something, right? There's 30 subnuclei in the amygdala. You know, if you stimulate the amygdala, you can actually get, you know, emotional responses. So I'm not claiming that, but this is what this data says to us. Okay. This is just a map of where the significant differences are. And from this gives us, you know, some basis for, in a new study, if I have a brain map, you know, what's the pattern of activity? What does that say about the experience versus perception balance? So I can use this as a starting point for those classifier analyses. Okay, so now I'll talk a little bit more about another kind of task brain activity association in meta-analysis. And there are some standard measures of association between tasks and brain, like the chi-squared test, Fisher's exact test, and so on. The basic setup for this is, I'm sort of calling this the MKDA framework, but all that means is that I've boiled each study map down to a set of ones or zeros, which means did it activate in this local neighborhood, this voxel, or did it not, right? So I'm going to end up with a map for every voxel in the brain of whether each of those contrast maps activated or didn't activate in that neighborhood. Next to that, I can put task condition labels, like disgust, fear, disgust, happiness, anger, and so on for these studies. And now I can look for regions, voxels in which there's a different distribution of ones, yeses, and no, one, zero, yes, no responses across these different categories. So I can do a chi-squared test. The other actually published chi-squared tests in some of the meta-analysis that we've done and other people have done have not done this, but I won't go into details on it. They've done a different kind of chi-squared test. The disadvantage here is it requires high expected counts in each cell. Many of these voxels in the brain within a particular local neighborhood, you're not going to get very high cell counts. You would need thousands of studies, you know, and even so, if the overall activation counts are low, then it's not going to work very well. So this wouldn't be a great test for a map-wise testing over many voxels. What we'd like to do, if we have two categories only, we could do Fisher's exact test. And that would be a good alternative, but what if we have more than two categories? We can do a multinomial exact test, and I'll just leave off the details and say you can do that. This would be a really good idea because you could get exact p-values for essentially inhomogeneous distribution across multiple categories like disgust, happiness, anger, and sadness, and fear. But even if you had about 80 contrast maps, no computer that we have access to could really do that in a reasonable amount of time, even for one voxel, combinatorial explosion. But what you can do is what I have called, potentially unfortunately in this case, the non-parametric chi-square test, which is what you're going to do is approximate this multinomial exact test by drawing samples. And it was going to work then for low expected counts. And I think I have a slide that illustrates how that might work. So the idea of the exact test is to preserve conditionalize on the marginal counts for activations and for task conditions. I don't want differences in the number of studies that have discussed versus happiness to drive any result, right? So I'm going to hold those things constant. I'm also going to hold for a given voxel the proportion of studies that activate constant. But what I really want to know is are the contingencies between those things consistent with what would be predicted by the marginal counts, or are they different? That's the basic principle behind the chi-squared test. And so the null hypothesis is that there's no systematic association, and the alternative hypothesis is that there is some association. And in the exact test, the p-value is the proportion of the null hypothesis possible combinations of these different arrangements that would produce the same marginal distributions. A little bit of technical thing, but I gotta say something technical because it's IPAM. All right. What I can do. Sorry. All right. Yes. Oh yeah. Okay. Packing. Oh yeah. Okay. Okay. So what I'm gonna do is permute these activity counts, holding the marginal frequencies constant. Take a bunch of samples from that distribution, like 5,000 or more, and I can then calculate p-value based on that permuted distribution. So that's what we've implemented and we've been doing. So you can do voxel by voxel tests of differences across multiple task types, voxel by voxel, using this procedure. Then I'm gonna skip this last point. The take home here, though, is that these tests are giving you different things. The density difference map, because the null hypothesis is based on this random distribution of each of those conditions across the brain, it's really giving you not absolute differences in the proportion of studies that activate in a particular area, it's giving you relative differences in activation, which can also be useful, but they're relative. The non-parametric chi-squared test that I just told you about actually gives you sort of absolute differences. Yes, a study is more likely to activate in this area if it's a experience study than if it's a perception study. So that's it. I'm going to skip this. We've done some classifier analyses and some other people have. I think this is a really promising way to go. If you look at the experience versus perception distinction, you see you can classify with about 80% accuracy, and there are differences across the brain that seem interesting and meaningful. So this is my last slide, since Tim told me to wrap up. And what have we done? Well, we've talked about consistency, which is the replicability across studies. Talked about consistency in single region results, MKDA. We can also talk about consistency in functional networks using these co-activation measures, which I didn't talk too much about. Specificity and reverse inference, which are the predictive value of how well you can predict psychological category mappings from individual brain regions. We can look at that with MKDA difference maps or with this non-parametric chi-squared test. And we can also then consider multiple regions at once and use any kind of machine learning pattern classifier system, essentially, to categorize or to calculate the predictive accuracy for particular psychological categories given given patterns of reported peaks in the meta-analysis. So that's sort of a little survey of some of the stuff that we've been doing, and I hope it gives you a flavor of the different kinds of applications that that we've been doing. So I'd like to thank, at the end here, my collaborators, including Martin Lindquist and Tom Nichols in statistics, Lisa Feldman Barrett in emotion, who's really worked to help put that emotion database together, and she wrote the manual. Students in my lab who have all done work on the meta-analysis, these projects that I presented, and my colleagues here in Michigan who worked on meta-analyses of cognitive function, and also the funding agencies. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions, if anyone has any questions for Tor.
I was wondering about your, first of all, I think it's Elliot, pretty straightforward solution to, you know, meta-analyses over at Haley. It's pretty good, but I was wondering about the reporting biases from individual investigators, where an investigator may report regions where he or she might want to report and leave out other regions. So I'm wondering, have you considered including a weighting factor for whether the paper comes from the same lab?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what that question does is it sort of illustrates that there are a number of things here that are, you know, that are not modeled, that essentially probably could be. Like, for example, some studies and some labs tend to use the same subjects over and over again. So there's non-independence across those different contrast maps for several reasons. You know, so that's sort of, you know, something that's not taken into account here. There are also differences. People will use one threshold for the brain and then use another threshold for the region of interest that they care about, which is probably a big part of the reason why the amygdala is so heavily represented with peaks in the emotion database, for example. Everybody looks in the amygdala. Even if they find something at a very low threshold, they tend to report it. So we've coded for that, but we haven't ended up actually excluding those studies or those peaks. It's kind of a tricky issue. One thing I should say is that these density analyses, because they use this null hypothesis global, you know, homogeneous distribution across the brain, if every study reports activity in the amygdala, there's going to be a lot of points there. That's actually going to make it harder to demonstrate significance in other areas of the brain as well. So one of the things we've done to help deal with that, which was implemented in the previous KDA analysis, was called a step-down test, which means once I find that the amygdala is activated, let's cut that out of the mask, take those points out, and then redo the whole test, you know, and look for additional areas.
So one thing we've always worried about when we analyze our data is the inclusion criteria for the papers that constitute coordinates. So can you say something about how you, what inclusion criteria you have for us?
Yes. So we have in different papers, you know, been somewhat different, but we tended to adopt an inclusive criterion. So instead of trying to pick out a very small set of studies we think are high quality for some particular reason, which is another good potential approach, we sort of wanted to get all the studies of a particular type, you know, and see what's consistent across those things. I think, you know, there's reasons to do both things, I suppose. I think, you know, going forward, as many more studies come out, it's going to become much easier to get enough of a large enough sample size of high quality studies. You could say only the random effects analysis, only the things that correct, you know, for example. So you know, differences in threshold is another problem. So you could be much more selective, I think. And that's one of the advantages of that explosion of papers. So that's one answer. It's a difficult, you know, the question to answer in a sort of general way.
So we'll take one more question back here, and then we'll take a short break before Lars speaks.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the things that you're trying to compensate for are just things in the way people are reporting their findings. And so one of the things that I was wondering is, like, down the road, do you have any suggestions to enforce guidelines on how things are being reported? Like, do you think we should just publish our SPM maps somewhere? Or is, like, what
would
you want to see?
I have a two-part answer to that question. Recently, a paper, including Ross and Tom and some other people, was put together that has sort of an agreed-upon list of reporting guidelines for imaging studies. So that's a good start. Also, the APA is revising its publication manual and actually considering explicitly the idea of what should you be reporting, right? So those are good, you know, helpful things.
Ambiguity is the biggest thing. When you look at papers and people just don't say what they did. As long as you're very clear, then we can always take that and run with it.
Yeah.
But when you leave out these great big gaps in how the analysis was done, just because maybe you clicked a bunch of buttons and SPM didn't quite know what was going on, that's the hardest part to compensate for.
Yeah. Oh, the one thing I did want to say was that, yes, so all of this, I now see all this using these peak reported peaks as a convenient way to try to reconstruct in some impoverished form the statistic map. And so what would be very helpful going forward is to actually get, and there's been discussion about how to do this really in a comprehensive way, to get statistic images from every study, the full maps, right? So, and that would be a huge, I think, improvement over these methods, you know? And I don't think that this means that this kind of method shouldn't be used, because it's often not feasible to actually do that, but that is really a good way to go if we can, you know, do it.
Okay, well, let's thank our speakers one more time.